Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. And that was our new theme song.
I dig it.
Yes.
Jarek and I had been talking, and I guess with the whole store, kind of about doing this for like a year or two.
Yeah.
Because of our kind of common love of sort of cheesy 80s TV openings and you know, 80s rock and stuff like that, which Jarek is a very talented amateur musician.
Yeah.
I did not know this.
Yeah, no, it's really fun. And that is, yes, that's the new Rogues Gallery theme song by Jarek Stewart with his dad on drums. And we'll have Jarek actually a little bit later on the podcast talking about it for just a minute.
You know, at some point we do need to film a video to it.
Yes, at some point we will do our 70s cop video.
Frames, yep. And yeah, and you can be the chief.
In our copious free time.
In our copious free time. Yes.
So this is the podcast for Wednesday, February 25th. It is the final week of our inventory sale, which we do every year.
Right, it snuck up on us.
The inventory discount is 65% plus duty 6, so you can get up to 77% off.
Yep.
There's some good stuff left on the table as we record this. All the G.I. Joe Cobra is on there.
It's such a good run.
It's a really good run.
The Mike Mignola, Howard Chaykin, Fafford and the Grey Mauser series.
Right.
I bought in prestige format when it first came out in individual thick issues. And it's a great early example of Mike Mignola's art if you like love him from Hellboy or something.
Yeah.
There's the other stuff.
Gillum March's art book, Cover Girls, is on there.
Yep. Such beautiful artwork in that book.
I actually just yesterday picked up one of a few copies we had of that. It was a source book that came out for 4th edition D&D, but it's system neutral. They're under...
The Menzo Barazin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all this stuff on the Dark Elves and the different, you know, clans in there. It has beautiful art and, you know... Lots of cool descriptions of the lives, you know, what it's like to live in the Underdark.
Yeah.
So, and there's still at least one copy, I think one copy left out there, but there's lots of stuff.
Yep. So that runs until Sunday.
Randy yawned.
Sorry. They can't see that. Why are you telling them that?
Because your voice went like,
maybe I like to roar.
Randy always roars.
Randy's roaring again.
He gives
Randy roars. That runs until Sunday.
That's how we should close the podcast, Randy, with we all do Randy roars.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So that runs until Sunday, and then we'll be closed on Monday, March 2nd for inventory. So if you come and pull on the door, nothing will happen.
Yep, that's
but you might see some crazy people inside yelling and screaming.
Yep. Probably usually by midday we start to break a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything becomes funny and or tragic.
Yes, for those who don't know, inventory is when we count everything in the store.
Yes. Yeah.
By
everything.
Hand.
Yeah, we're not like one of these fancy places where we have electronic scanning and stuff like that. This is hands-on stuff and pages and pages.
You get a more accurate count that way.
It's true. It's true. It's interesting.
So next weekend, not this coming weekend, but next weekend is Staple.
Yes.
Right. Which we are co-sponsoring, and that is going to be, I think we've talked about it before, but tons of people in there. Babstar from Batgirl, the three-fourths of the Lumberjanes crew.
Dean Tripp.
Dean Tripp is going to be there. Jess Fink. It's a good lineup. Plus, like 150 other exhibitors from around Austin and Houston and Dallas.
Yeah, if you go by Staple or the Staple blog, there's interviews with some of the creators. There's some preview art. I mean, it's an awesome lineup.
And it's just a great event and a great place to go and meet people and see cool art.
Yep, and I'll be out there manning the table both days. I believe that Dave and Teal will be wandering around one of the days.
Yep.
Nick will be wandering around one of those days.
Me and my wife will probably be wandering around one day as well.
So you might see us there.
Yep, we're going to trash the place.
Wait, what?
Wait,
don't announce that.
Then the following Monday is Ladies' Night at the Outback. That's Monday, March 9th. Reading with Rogues, Astro City is Tuesday, March 10th. And Gaming with Rogues, Ticket to Ride, is Monday, March 16th. All the details on that, as always, on our website and on the Facebook page. And now we're going to talk a bit of news. So they revealed Jason Momoa's Aquaman costume this week.
Yeah. Right. Cinema news, yes.
Yes.
This is like, if you happen to be on Facebook and you're a geek, this is probably everything that your friends were all talking about this least one day.
I was
going to
say,
week.
Wasn't it like when it first released, I think, on Thursday night?
Yeah. Yeah.
It basically, my Facebook feed just blew up, and that's all everyone was talking about.
It was like a Too Many Cooks style thing where it just took over everything.
Too many Aquaman?
And I think the costume looks good. I wish there was some color to it.
But that's how all of the sort of promotional
is that just the promo art?
Yes.
And I think it just might be them skewing the colors a little
bit. I guess, but I thought Man of Steel was kind of washed out in color-wise.
It was. It's
true.
It's clearly a deliberate stylistic choice.
Yeah, I just don't like it.
Yeah, I don't either. It kind of like, I want a little bit of brightness to my DC guys.
But as a look in general, I thought it was fine.
Yeah,
I
mean, that said, the costume actually looks like the Barbarian Aquaman that Peter David wrote for a long time.
Yeah, it's more or less a variant, on that Savage Aquaman that we've seen off and on since, what, like late 80s?
Yeah. Although I did see somebody post that he had too many hands.
What?
Because that was the Hook Hand Aquaman.
Oh, right. What was it? I think one of our customers, Joseph Compton, I think called him Water Conan, which is also kind of true.
I think it would have been ballsy if they had done the Hook Hand Aquaman. That'd be cool.
Oh, I could see him getting his hand cut off in this movie.
Oh, I could too.
But they're not going to start with it. That's got to be the dramatic thing.
Yeah.
You know, it had the tagline in it, which has not been explained, but is fairly
self-explanatory.
What is it? Unite the Seven?
Unite the Seven.
I actually posted, somebody did an awesome Photoshop mock-up.
I've seen a lot of memes of Unite the Seven.
What was it? Who's the guy, Steve Carell from Anchorman with the trident?
Yes.
It was beautiful.
Yeah.
But presumably this will be, he will in some way unite the big seven of the Justice
League. Well, no, I don't think he's a uniter. I think that's going to be a tagline they put over all the reveals.
You think so?
Yeah.
I wondered if that might be sort of the role they give him, though, is he, as you know, maybe like as a king or something, is the guy who puts them together.
Maybe.
That would sort of give, you know, since Aquaman is sometimes a person that the writers don't know what to do with, that would give him a key role, like he's the guy who forms them.
We'll see. Yeah, I don't know. I just assumed that was going to be the movie tagline,
that's interesting. Yeah,
Justice League tagline.
I can see that, but I bet everybody's going to have separate taglines.
We'll see.
Divide the Seven. Whoa.
Run really fast.
Be Amazonian.
This is why we don't work in marketing in DC.
Really? Batmobiles?
Batmobile.
It just says Batmobile.
Shields.
Actually, it just says my parents are dead.
All right.
I think, on its own, it's a good look. It still seems, you know, all a little grim and gritty for me, but that is kind of the obvious direction of the DC movie.
Yeah, that's what they're doing.
It is what it is.
Yeah. Moving on, we have what I'm going to call Nick's Secret Wars Roundup, because Nick has been keeping up on all the Secret Wars news, and they have revealed a lot of books and creative teams when this all starts in May.
Yeah, these are all books coming out between like May and June.
Yeah, so like the same way, like a couple weeks back, we went through the Convergence spinoffs from DC.
Yeah.
We do a quick run through of some of the notable ones.
And this isn't all of them, because there are a few that I think got released a few weeks back.
These will be concurrent with the Secret Wars series.
Correct. These will fall under the headings of Battle World, Last Days.
It's all crazy stuff that will be occurring on this Battle World mosaic of all these other timelines and everything, right?
Exactly, because this entire Secret Wars, they all cohabitate with one another, so they have to work with one another or, you know, battle with one another, of course.
Speaking of mosaics, Randy, where's my Green Lantern mosaic trade paperback?
Dave, I believe that is right there alongside something else that's never getting
paid. I remember liking Mosaic, but it's been so long. It was such a weird title.
You know who did the art of Mosaic? It's Kelly Hamner.
Yeah. Mm. And it was like the Dave, if I'm not mistaken, it was like the David Lynch of Green Lantern
sci-fi. It was weird as hell. I loved that book.
Yeah. So weird. Yeah.
Never read them.
Very ambitious.
Yeah.
Like David Lynch or The Prisoner.
I remember I was working at a shop at the time, and it was one of those books that nobody knew what to make. Like, either loved it or hated it.
Yeah. I remember I read that first issue, and I was torn between those two polls.
Yeah. Because it's very strange, but I loved it, and it was too ambitious. It was way out of its time.
Maybe I'll buy some 50-cent back issues somewhere.
There you go.
Nick, I'm sorry to interrupt. I did not expect to talk about Green Lantern Mosaic, but let's get back to something that will actually sell and possibly be enjoyed.
No one ever expects the Green Lantern Mosaic. Its chief weapon is surprise.
Okay, so I'm going to run down a few books and give a few small synopsis just because. So the first one I want to talk about is Planet Hulk, which has Captain America and Devil Dinosaur traversing a world of inhabited all by Hulks, different versions of him.
You know, that sounds a little crazy, but after Remender?
Yeah.
He did that Cap world where his Captain America run launched in Dimension Z with a year-long Game of Thrones apocalyptic kind of, like, otherworldly thing going on with Cap. So it's not too crazy.
No, and it's going to be written by Sam Humphries. And I always forget if he was the one who was writing Avengers Arena.
I mixed him up with Dennis Hopeless. Yeah, and I think Dennis Hopeless was doing Avengers Arena.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Hey, Google him.
And art by Mark Lamming. I don't know. I just kind of want to know what Devil Dinosaur and Captain America talk about.
Nothing. He's a dinosaur.
He can't talk.
He can't talk. Moon Boy can
sign. Moon Boy can talk. I believe he's more like Lassie.
Yeah.
Where he indicates there's intelligence, but no chit chat.
I'm just curious as to what brings those two characters together.
Except instead of finding kids in wells, he finds other dinosaurs to eat.
That's right.
What's that devil? Another dinosaur needs to be killed and eaten?
You say there's a yummy-looking stegosaurus trapped in a well.
Like I said, some of these are very odd.
So yeah, let's
all of these are very odd.
Ghost Racers, number one.
This sounds kind of fun.
Which is written by Felipe Smith, who's been writing all new Ghost Rider. Art by Juan Gedeon. Don't know much
new
about
new guy,
him,
I think.
But we have seen some preview art from this, and I really do love the designs of the different Ghost Riders. But basically, at its core, this is Death Race 2000 meets the Roman Colosseum.
Yeah,
this is a sort of blood sport race with all the Ghost Riders.
Yeah, and they're sort of vying for freedom. If they win this race, they basically become free for a period of time, and they can roam.
I'm still having a hard time conceptualizing what this battle world is going to look like and how it's going to have all these alternate things existing. Like, do they know that they're plucked from a different universe? Have they been living this life in this world?
I guess that is what you have to read Secret Wars for.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I know.
Infinity Gauntlet, which was a super popular series by Jim Starlin.
Yep.
This one is going to be written by Dustin Weaver and Gary Dugan. I think it's actually Gary Dugan and art by Dustin Weaver.
Dustin Weaver's co-writing.
Oh, he's co-writing. Yep. Anyways, this is about a new family who was connected to the Nova Corps. So it's like an actually family dynamic, kids, parents, all fighting against Thanos, who's after sort of a cosmic artifact.
Okay.
Which is kind of interesting, sort of like the Incredibles.
Incredibles in space or Incredibles versus Galactus.
Yeah, something like that. I'm curious. Old Man Logan, which is a super popular story by Mark Miller and Steve McNiven. Which sees its return as Old Man Logan sort of traverses the entirety of Battleworld, sort of going different places.
How come there aren't like a bunch of Wolverines?
I think there are.
Oh, okay.
But Old Man Logan is like Kane from Kung Fu. He just walks the bird. Walks the battle.
I mean, I think that's probably what they're going to do, yeah, actually.
Bendis is definitely going to utilize sort of the Clint Eastwood version of Old Man Logan and sort of just continue on. And this is Bendis writing and then Andrea Sorrentino doing artwork. Who dat? I don't recognize... I mean, I recognize the name, but I can't tell you exactly what he's
I believe it's an Italian artist who's done other stuff, yes.
Yeah, we can Google it.
Yeah. Also is Where Monsters Dwell, which actually sounds like a lot of fun. It's Garth Ennis writing and art by Russ Braun, who I'm not super familiar with, but I know you...
He's an old-school war comics guy.
Right. Yeah. And this one is going to focus on the Phantom Eagle, which... old school war Marvel
he's
comics
a, he's, a pilot. He's a pilot. He's a sup with camel type pilot.
Basically him fighting dinosaurs.
Garth Ennis can go to any comics company and find their war character.
Yeah.
That's his secret power.
That's his power. He's got a special sense.
He could go to Gold Key Comics and he'd be like, remember those war comics you published for 1 year in 1958?
And they'll
do a new spin on it.
And they'll be like, no. He's like, well, I'd like to write them.
Because, I mean, War Stories sells well enough.
Yeah.
And, you know.
He has done so many, he's obviously good at it.
He's a war fan.
He is a war fan.
So, and then we have Spider-Verse, which if anyone was sort of a fan of the Spider-Man crossover Spider-Verse, which wrapped up, I guess, 2 weeks at this point.
Yep, yep.
This is about a small group of spiders, including, like, Spider-Gwen and Spider-Ham and a few others, I think Spider-Man Noir, sort of finding out what makes Battleworld tick. So this might actually have some pretty big revelations. The description of this one is a little less because I think there are going to be some big happenings in this one.
That's interesting. Then Spider-Man's like still a core Marvel hero, so him learning about Battleworld sort of makes sense.
And it's written by Mike Costa, who actually wrote the G.I. Joe Cobra that we mentioned that's on our sale table.
Yep.
He's also done a lot of other books. And art by Andrea Arjo? I can't pronounce that one. I'm sorry. Inferno, which, if anybody can remember X-Men Inferno,
that was one of the big early...
People remember X-Men Inferno.
I read it. I enjoyed it as a kid. As
slightly less
well-known
than, like, Days of Future Past or the Age of Apocalypse, but still pretty well-known.
Yeah, this one is going to be written by Dennis Hopeless, so Avengers Arena
Guy.
Art by Javier Garon, and basically it sees the X-Men lose Inferno, and they have to basically give up that that portion of Manhattan, which is run by the Goblin Queen, I would imagine, and all the demons.
And magic.
And magic. And this sees, because it's magic, Colossus can't give up, so he actually steps into the leader role and leads a small group of X-Men back in to sort of save the day.
Yep.
Sounds good.
Which I actually think is kind of cool. I mean, seeing Colossus in a leader role, I don't know if we've ever seen that.
You know, probably at some point, but I can't think of it.
I remember sort of in Age of Apocalypse, he was given sort of as the headmaster role in the end of, like,
yeah.
in that world. So there was that, but he ended up getting killed. Spoilers. And then just today it was released a book called Thors, which is maybe for the time being taking place of the all-new Thor that Jason Aaron's been doing.
It sounds like it would.
I'm not sure, but he is taking up this as Jason Aaron's writing it. Art is going to be by Chris Sprouse, who, if you read that issue of Multiversity that he did, I think he did the pulp one.
Yeah, Chris Sprouse is super talented.
Yep.
He is
I've liked him since I first saw him.
He was also a DC exclusive just until recently.
I first saw him on the Legion of Superheroes at DC in like the earlier mid-90s.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So he's been doing good work since way back when. And he's way talented.
And this also, this one is sounds actually kind of fun because it's basically a police drama. The tagline is a police drama with hammers instead of guns.
Multiple Thors will but be it is the multiple policing Thors. Units of the whole secret
yeah,
battle
I,
world.
That is what I understand, and it's going to have Throg Thor.
that is to say Thor Frog.
Thor Frog, yes. And also the new female Thor, regular Thor. I think
who's,
I saw,
who's 90s Thor?
I think there's Thunderstrike on there involved. Yeah. I know Odin involved. I'm secretly hoping that he's going to be the chief. Just for fun of it.
I've got... who would chew him out? Who's City Hall for him? I've got the Beyonder chewing me out for these violations.
And then last but least, they...
Is Better A Bill going to be in it?
Yes, Better A Bill is on the cover of the first one. And then there is the Age of Ultron versus Marvel Zombies, which is just...
That sounds like one of the weirdest ones to me.
Which weirdly got announced today as an ongoing... Don't know if I completely believe that, but
no
they are announcing it. It is James Robinson writing, and I'm blanking on who's doing the art.
Steve Pugh,
who did like Animal Man and Swamp Thing for DC more recently.
I don't know quite how it's going to work, but in some way, the dark future of the Age of Ultron will intersect with the dark present slash future of the Marvel Zombies.
Yeah, somehow they are together, and they're kind of like this weird.
Is this robots versus zombies, basically?
Essentially, robots versus zombies. Who'd win? And I know these all sound kind of wacky, sound kind of crazy. I actually think a lot of them, to me, sound very interesting. I'm super excited for Secret Wars.
It sounds like they're having fun using the Marvel Universe as a playground for kind of, like, stories with a more epic sweep.
Yep. It sounds like they've got a random die generator. They're like, roll, Captain America, roll, Devil Dinosaur, roll, Hulks, that's a book.
You know what I think, Randy? It's one of those old 60s computers with a lot of lights and
yeah.
like a ticker tape with, like...
Yeah, yeah.
But from what I understand, people pitch these stories.
They were sort of told, think big.
Yeah.
And now, when you say pitch these stories, do you mean they were handed a blindfold and three darts? And they threw them at a wall full of characters? You hit Hulk and Captain America and Devil Dinosaur? That's your book.
I heard an interview with Mike Costa saying that he had pitched this a while back and a few other things, you know.
It's like, what if I did something with Spider-Man? Like, okay, well, how about this? Every Spider-Man character, and it's on Battleworld. And he's like, well, I kind of want to do Ghost Rider. Well, how about this? It's every Ghost Rider, and they're racing.
But, I mean, that is – it seems like Battleworld in a weird way is kind of about – I don't want to say excess, but it is about, like a hyper mashup of Marvel concepts.
Yo, dog, I heard you like Ghost Rider, so put Ghost Rider in your Ghost Riders.
I'm actually very curious to see how each of these little worlds on this bigger continent sort of interact and coexist with one another because – from the solicits and the talk that they've done, that's a big thing.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious to see how that pans out.
And I don't think we've seen this before, to be honest. Something like this, we've seen alternate realities, we've seen multiple versions of characters, but all these alternate realities coexisting together, I think that's new. I can't think of any time. Even Crisis on Infinite Earths wasn't really doing that. They were jumping between them.
Right, or it would just be characters.
I mean, this
meeting
is a huge
other.
Roll of the dice.
It's
very interesting. I don't know if it's going to hit for everyone,
starts in May and launches
with the Free Comic Book Day issue that Marvel's putting out.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're going to go to a semi-regular new segment, 50th podcast, people. So there's new segments, new theme song, exciting stuff.
Gladiator matches.
Gladiator matches. Ghost Rider racing.
Devil Dinosaur.
Devil Dinosaur. This is a semi-regular segment, thank you, that we're going to be doing called Scenes from a Wednesday, where we talk to people here on New Comics Day and ask them a question.
Yep.
And then we get their answer. So this will be a bunch of our customers. And if you're here on Wednesdays, you know, you can come in and answer the question. If you are a listener, you can send us suggestions for questions that we can ask. And we won't do this every week, but every few weeks we'll do this and record a few people. So prepare yourself for a montage. First, we're going to open with...
do we need to say what the question is?
Yes, I will. Oh. We're going to open with Jarek Stewart, who is also talking about his the theme song, because I asked him about that this time. But the question we asked was, what's your current favorite comic? All right, now we have with us someone who we've talked about much on this podcast and who provided the new theme music you just heard at the top, Mr. Jarek Stewart.
How's it going, guys?
Hey. So tell us about the theme music.
So kind of inspired by classic 80s tunes and my favorite stuff. Got some new programs and things to work with on my my music stuff and figured I'd make a theme song for the store.
Yes, and that is awesome. And the backing drums?
My father actually provided those and... we tweaked them up, made them sound real nice. So
cool. Yeah. Well, hopefully you guys enjoyed it. We enjoyed it, and it's going to be that's our theme song from now on. And Jarek, our question of the week is: what is your favorite comic
right now? I'm gonna have to go with Grayson.
Yeah.
They've been Tim Seeley's been knocking out of the park for me, so really happy with that one.
Austin Taylor, my favorite comic would be probably Hawkeye. Not a big Hawkeye fan, but this new series, the Matt Fraction thing, mm-hmm. it's fantastic. Yeah. Batman Eternal, because it's weekly and it's Snyder, and God, what else? Sex Criminals, just because it's Sex Criminals. So I think that's probably my top, yeah.
Harry Livesey and anything with Wonder Woman right now, I love. And happy 50th episode, by the way.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kalman, and here are some of my favorite books. The Life After, Wild's End, East of West, Alex and Ada, Manifest Destiny, of course Saga and Lazarus. Autumn Lands, Non-Player, if and when it ever comes out again. Brass Sun, which promises to come out again. And then there are a couple of artists that I will buy no matter what they do. Richard Corbin, currently doing Rat God. Brandon Graham, who did King City. And Jeff Darrow's Shaolin Cowboy.
My name's Mario Alvarez. And, my favorite all-time comic and current comic is Amazing Spider-Man. Just kind of have great to have Peter Parker back, after the whole Superior thing. And, it's really, really fun. I've been recently getting into Black Science, which is Rick Remender. Love the artwork and just kind of like love the dark tone of it. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Allison Murphy, and my favorite comic right now is Rat Queens. I strongly identify with these characters. For a lot of reasons that I probably shouldn't state on a recorded media.
I'm Jason Murphy, and I think my favorite comic right now is Jason Aaron's Southern Bastards. I like to refer to it as its unspoken alternate title, Son of Walking Tall.
Yeah, so this is Nathan Killian, and unfortunately my favorite comic at the moment is ending this month, which is She-Hulk. Just not an art style I expected that I would like, but it's been really beautiful, and just the story has been something far more interesting than I would have expected a lawyery story to be, especially having already followed Daredevil. But I've really, really, really enjoyed it. Really sad that it's going to go. Hopefully, Charles Soule will figure out a way to bring it back here for a little bit. I think there's been a lot of desire for that to come back. So hopefully we'll see more than just the 12 issues that we already got.
All right, my name is Rico Allen, and my favorite book would be Justice League and Amazovirus series. Yeah. I'm really enjoying it. Looking forward to how it's going to turn out with Lex Luthor. And my next one, top of my favorite, since I'm a huge Batman fan, would be The Endgame by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. Very, very huge fan of that series. Love The Court of Owls. That's my favorite. So Endgame is a plus. To see how they did Joker to being like an immortal. Can't wait to see how that's going to turn out as well.
This is Stephen Carter. My picks would be the new D&D comic, Baldur's Gate. I absolutely love the writing and art style, which I'm not really an art person, but I really think it's a lot of fun. Kudos for having a main character as a hamster. I will also throw out that the new Thor is fantastic. We're only a couple of episodes in, and she has really just wowed me with the way that she's being portrayed. Finally, I'm going to throw out a big shout out for Empowered, which is one of the few comics or graphic novels that I actually look forward to whenever it comes out. So that's my picks.
Thomas Patchery III, or Goat Boy, if you know me locally. Favorite books right now are probably Uber, Saga, and mostly any of the new Image stuff came out. Pretty much anything Grant Morrison writes.
So that was a bunch of favorite comics. And guys, what about you? Nick, what is your favorite comic at the moment?
My favorite comic right now is All New Thor.
Cool.
I'm trying to think. That's Jason Aaron. Who's the artist on it?
It is Russell Dauterman, and who's been doing the main stuff. There was one book that came out that is that he did not do the artwork.
One guest issue.
Yep.
Dave.
Right now, put on the spot. I think the new Star Wars from Marvel is probably the one I'm most looking forward to each month. They seem to have caught the tone.
And mine is Remains Saga, actually, which is always a favorite of mine, and just came back from its long hiatus with number 25.
That comic's dirty and gross.
Yep.
And awesome. I know
it. So this time we're doing a special segment for our 50th anniversary. This is normally where we do comics talk, but as you may know, the weather, we don't have our comics yet. And hopefully
we're going to cover those probably next week, right?
Hopefully, we'll cover them next week. Hopefully, by the time you hear this, we have comics and it's all invisible to you. But we're all very nervous right now that comics may not even show up tomorrow, and we'll be doing a Wednesday, Thursday poll. And
but that said, there are some great comics coming out this week.
It's a good week. Spider-Gwen,
Darth Vader number two.
I don't even remember all it
four
was.
Four annual.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of cool stuff.
Yeah. If we've done many a late arrival week where we pull on Wednesday, and I think generally, unless you are there right at 10 a.m. and you see us pulling the books
it's invisible,
haste, you won't even see it. So hopefully that's our best case scenario.
Yes, but that is a bit of nuts and bolts behind the scenes, which brings me to this segment, which is us talking about sort of how we get into comics retail, why we do what we do, sort of our philosophy about it.
Yep.
I'll just start off with how we got into this. So Dave, how did you get into comics retail?
I stumbled into it.
Nick, would you say it was a plan for you, like a detailed plan?
No, God,
would you
no.
say you stumbled into it?
I remember completely. I gotten my other job closed down, so I remember coming into the store and basically saying, "I have to pare down books because I don't have a job at the moment." And then I think the next day I got a call from one of you guys. I can't remember. He's like, "Do you want to work on Sundays?"
Yes. Well, I wouldn't say I stumbled into it. I more fell backwards into it. So yeah, I believe that's pretty common. What is your exact specific?
I was a retail manager over at Toys R Us and had just gotten sick of the job. So I was looking for something, some new horizon, but not in a place I was comfortable with. As it happens, I was shopping at Dragon's Lair, and I think I was talking with one of the managers there, and Cecilia.
It was Cecilia.
Who was a great staffer that I worked with and trained with. And I think she sort of did the same thing that we did with Nick, which is where it was she's like, somehow it came out that I was not liking my other job. I was not fishing for work or anything like that. And she said, do you have any interest in working here? I think she had picked up at least – I was real quiet. Like, I did not talk a lot. But I guess they had picked up enough in conversing with me that I knew comics pretty well.
Well, you read a bunch of art nerd comics.
I did.
So,
I
like,
did.
Oh, this guy knows his comics.
That's kind of true. I guess they knew my subscription.
Well
– And so I came on specifically sort of as the comics guy or as a comics hire, not knowing much about the game side of things, but I threw myself into that. So.
Yeah. And I was working – I had just finished coming off a job. I was reviewing comics for Newsarama. Which was my full-time job for about a year and a half, was reviewing comics, and that was great. It was sort of winding down as this was the dot-com era, and a lot of stuff was bursting. And I got a call from David Wheeler, the owner of Dragon's Lair, and he said...
By the way, when I was working at Dragon's Lair a little bit before you, I remember you used to come by and steal our free previews of Marvel and DC Comics so you could review them.
And you hated it.
Because they hooked you up with them. And we all hated you.
Yep.
But also privately, I was jealous because I really wanted to do the reviewing thing too.
Right. And unlike how you all hate me now. It's a different kind of hatred.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the main difference.
But I got a call from David Wheeler, and he said, well, how would you like a badly paying job? And I said, okay. And this,
that's,
I think,
really how we kind of have the
common,
to everybody.
This is the common thread that I think is interesting. We are always scouting for new people. Like,
yeah.
we get the question constantly, like, do you have any openings? People want to work here. And it's usually people who have never been in the shop before and don't know our stuff, and they're just looking for a job, and that is not how we hire.
Right. There's also kind of that common belief that we sit around reading comics all day.
This is very much not the job. I wish that was the job. The job is very much stressing about ordering and scheduling and that
right.
kind of thing.
There is essentially always something to be done at the store.
Yeah.
We do occasionally read a comic or two.
Yeah.
Although in a weird way, even that is part of the job.
Yeah, because you need to know
really
them.
Yeah. Product. But there's a lot of, do we need to restock this? Do we need to reorder this? Does this section need fixing? Who's going to schedule our next events?
Yeah, on top of all the general customer service things of like trying
mm-hmm.
to make people happy and answering questions and all that kind of thing. So it is a job.
Right,
but
definitely.
What I think is interesting is that a lot of our regular customers probably don't know that we're always like, well, if they ever need a job, we'd hire them. Of course, we never feel like we're doing them a favor because this job does not pay particularly well.
Right.
The three of us are able to sort of make a living to some extent because we're in the management positions.
I mean,
but even then, we're never going to be wealthy people.
No.
And that's sort of something you kind of got to accept a little with the comics retail thing, unless you like own like a big chain or something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people can do well with it if they can do the chain. I'm not that kind of guy, so.
But that said, we also, I think, most of us do love the job.
Yeah.
Not every single moment.
Nope.
There's frustrations, but you know what I was thinking about when we were talking about doing this segment is the thing I like most about the job
mm-hmm.
Is that sort of that basic, it's something I liked even at Toys R Us, where is I like matching up people with something that they want.
Yeah, that's and that's the thing. You and I both did reviews, and so did Nick.
Yep.
And this is an extension of comic reviewing, where some people take comic reviewing and it's a thing where all they want to do is trash books they hate.
Yeah.
We were always looking to talk about the stuff we loved.
Oh, I could sometimes
trash I could. Yeah, I'm not saying I didn't do that.
Yeah,
but that's not where the gratification came.
No.
I never felt great after writing a bad review. I always felt kind of like, ugh.
That was part of the job you had to do.
You had to do it because that was something that was required, but it's... I really loved writing a good review.
And this is essentially, we were trying to match up the blind audience we couldn't see with the comics we liked and thought they would like.
Right.
Comics retail is like a boutique version of that, where we get to actually get a sense of the person's tastes and try to put a book in their hand that we think will match what we can tell about their tastes.
Randy, I don't know if I'm pretty sure you remember this, like, some years ago, one of our customers, Dave Figueroa,
mm-hmm.
Came in, and he was just getting into comics, or maybe looking back into it after a while.
Yep.
And we pointed him to Walking Dead. We thought he might like this pretty new comic, Walking Dead, or maybe it was a few volumes in.
Yeah.
And the next day he came in, and in his inimitable Brooklyn accent, he's like, oh, you guys, this comic was good. You know? He's like, I want to shake your hands. And he actually came up and like shook our hands. He was so happy with it. And those are the kind of moments I live for.
Yeah. Not that everyone should shake our hands.
But everybody should talk in a Brooklyn accent.
We're gross human beings, and we will give you the plague.
Wow. Only during the winter flu months.
Right. But yeah, no, that's totally it. When you... The thing, Amanda, one of our new staffers, like one of her best days early on when she got to recommend like the first comic a little girl had ever read.
Yeah.
And that's the rewarding part of this job.
Yeah. And we get that a fair amount.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite days to work is Free Comic Book Day.
Free Comic Book Day is the best.
Because all those little kids get to see comics, and some don't ever see comics in that way or have never seen a comic before in their life, and they get to grab five or six of them, and they walk away super happy.
Yeah.
Or start laying on the floor reading through their comics, which is
right.
also
yeah.
really cool.
Yeah.
There's more sort of good mojo on that day than any other day of
yeah.
the year.
Yeah. Also, this is just – I mean, honestly, for me, this is a job – I get to come and work with my best friends every day.
Yeah.
That's a great job. You don't get to do that a lot.
We get to podcast and talk about awesome comics and game stuff.
Yes.
We're not wealthy, but we have pretty good peace of mind and
yeah.
pretty happy lives.
Yep. I think that's why we do this thing, and why mm-hmm. I think the general philosophy of Rogues is we want people to read comics.
Yeah.
And play games.
Awesome
in a way
things.
I think that's probably why it's also we don't focus much on the speculative side of the industry.
Yeah.
I know that that's that, you know, people can enjoy that or the variant covers and things, but I think for us it's the stories more than anything.
I think I mean, for myself, I view it as a source of entertainment. I mean, and you can do the, you know, do the variant covers or the older comics, and that's great. We all have those. But for me, it is the stories and sort of losing myself in another world. That's why I've always loved comics.
Just every once in a while, I've had somebody come in, sometimes who's they've inherited a collection or something like that. And they, you know, want to know if it's worth anything. And so, you know, a lot of times it's stuff from like the 80s or 90s that hasn't held much value.
Right.
And they're kind of like, they're like, well, what, you know, what would you do with them, or why else would anybody want them? And the answer is, of course, to read them.
Yeah,
you know? I'm like, there are great stories in there. There are also terrible stories in there.
Yeah, sure.
But the good stuff is as good as any entertainment medium.
Yeah. Now, we talk a lot about comics, but we're also all game guys.
Oh, yeah.
I had to ease into it, which was a really exciting time of discovery.
Yeah.
Randy, I think, you know, I had just once or twice as a kid dabbled a little bit with games.
Yeah.
But the first RPGs I ever played were basically with your group.
That's right. I didn't realize that was your first, like, really your first game.
Growing up did the RPG stuff, right?
He did. So I, like, watched him from afar, but he's several years older than I am. Yeah. So I wasn't in with his, like, group of friends. Yeah.
Yeah. Same with me. My brother played them. I remember them vividly, you know, sitting in our basement in Maryland playing. Uh-huh. He would never let me sit at the table.
Bastards.
So I'd always have to.
You guys never
afar.
Got to play the reindeer games?
No.
What?
Reindeers and dragons? Reindeer games? No, I started playing D&D when I was like 11 with a neighborhood friend, uh-huh. and then played all through high school, all through college. I played every RPG. I played Star Wars D6. I played Star Frontiers. I played Shadowrun. Any number of different little games. Top Secret. Yeah. Every role-playing game, every world of D&D, I played a ton of role-playing games in high school and college. And then I played Champions a lot throughout college, and that's what I ran for you and some of our other staffers.
Yep.
But the thing for me that I discovered relatively late was board games. Like, I played a few. I played the Steve Jackson. I played Car Wars and that kind of thing. But of the last – just the last, like, 3 or 4 years, I've sort of really gotten into the Euro games and some of that stuff that we carry so heavily.
Right, yeah, I don't think any of us necessarily – that was like sort of our initial entry point into it.
Yeah.
But we've all discovered, oh, there's a reason these are so popular.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just had a board game night last weekend.
Yeah.
And
we
finally
play a lot of it,
played Machi Koro for the first time, played King of Tokyo again, played Settlers of Catan.
You know what was funny for me is I used to in the 90s, I played one of the first big MMOs, EverQuest.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really enjoyed it, but I only played it for maybe about a year or so, very, very intensely in that time. And what I was finding was what I wanted to do was the role-playing side of it.
Yeah.
And the game was not really serving that.
No.
You could sometimes find role-players, but, you know, most people were kind of about the loot, the hacking, the slashing.
Yeah.
And that's what it was good at. And that's what, you know, World of Warcraft and other games are good at, too. And so when I found out that tabletop games did provide that role-playing experience, that was a big thing for me.
Yeah.
And I'm always finding cool new stuff in our product, too. Like, a few years ago, I kind of realized that I was veering more towards the indie games.
Yeah.
And the more of those I've discovered and the more I've played, the more I've liked them. And so, you know, like that game we played a few weeks ago, Dread, which is a weird little and standalone indie horror game, was super fun and is the kind of thing I would never have known about but for sort of working here.
Right. Nick, you haven't done as much role playing games as
no.
You tend to do short run games, right?
Yeah, I did.
You've done a fair. I mean, you've played a lot of D&D.
Oh yeah, no. After starting working here, previous to that, I'd never played very many role playing games, if any. But afterwards, yeah, I ran a 2-year campaign of Dungeons and Dragons during 4th edition, and I've run a lot of like flex games for people. And
yeah,
stuff
that's
like
just
that.
My homebrew.
Yeah,
right. More or less tied to the Fate system,
Spirit of the Century type stuff.
The official game of Rogue's Gallery.
But yeah, no, and I've played in numerous. You know, I played in one of your Champions at one, or maybe not Champions. It was one of the ones where I was a brick, and I remember I had like 30 dice that I rolled.
That was Champions.
The only other game that could have been would be Shadowrun, but yeah,
no, it was Champions. And you know, from then I've played a lot of different role playing games, and I've loved every single one. And same with board games. I mean, growing up, you always played the obligatory, you know, Monopoly or all that other stuff, but. You know, working here, seeing sort of the amount of different games and the amount of different genres each game can cover and sort of game mechanics. I mean, you kind of open your eyes and you're like, there's so many cool things to play and to see. And,
well,
you know, where I can play this train game that doesn't sound fun, but it's one of the most amazing games ever.
Yeah.
In Ticket to Ride.
Yeah.
Just the other day, I was visiting my mom, and she's like, it's been too long since we played Settlers of Catan. We need to play that.
Yeah.
She probably would not know about that game, but for the fact that I was working here.
Right.
Although I might have ended up, you know, as a just at a customer, you know, at another shop or something like that, and discovered some of these things, but being able to sort of immerse myself in it is one of the great pleasures of the job.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe we have a current standing list of like five games that we want to play if we could find time.
Finding time
yeah. Finding time is the hard part.
Yeah. It's the toughest thing for any gamer as an adult.
Yep, yep. All right. Well, that about wraps up our Rogue's 50th segment of why we do this and why on earth anyone would do this. And it occurs to me that it'd be a kind of a fun thing to do in the future, sort of a ask us questions about comic retail that we could answer. So
yeah, sure.
If anyone has questions about comics or gaming retail, whether they're specific to Rogues or general, how does this work, send them in. We've got the email link at the end of the podcast, and we'd love to hear them. And we'll be back in just a few seconds. Now we are back for another hopefully regular segment. This is all depends on you guys. This is our reader questions, or listener questions, I suppose is more accurate. And we're going to start doing a thing when we read a question on the air, we're going to provide a pack of like three or four comics that we will hand select from our bins.
Yep.
To give
a little gift bag.
As a gift bag to whoever asks the question. So the first comics pack will go out to Steve Maggi, who has asked a question on this podcast before.
Yep.
And he has the question for this week.
He's got a good one.
And the question is, I've noticed over the years that today's artists draw more details into the superheroes' costumes. For example, when I was a kid through college, Batman's eyes were just white objects in his cowl all the time. The boots looked like socks, and he had his underpants on the outside. Now, I learned from an artist friend later that superheroes wearing contrasting underoos was an anatomy cheat. But today, Batman's eyes are visible up close, you can see the treads on the bottom of his boots, and his costume resembles armor with molding lines. Is this a result of technology improving in printing? The paper is much better than it was up in the 80s. Is it a movement amongst artists to be more realistic? I know movies have had some influence, but that tends to be temporary. What's your inside baseball take or explanation?
So, you know, just first off, art has been kind of getting more realistic. Not all artists, but in general for decades.
I think that's generally true.
Yeah. I feel like the 70s was probably the big leap forward with a few artists like Neil Adams.
Yeah.
And maybe Michael Golden, if you've ever seen some of his earlier material.
I was even thinking like Jim Aparo.
To
some extent.
I think what happens is, you know, you go from like the Silver Age Batman who, you know, basically the classic superhero more or less was a naked person with a few lines drawn to indicate gloves and their logo and stuff like that. I mean, artists have always done that.
Yeah.
Because they're usually very good figurative artists, but guys like Neil Adams started like you would see a close up of Batman's cowl, and instead of just being a few lines indicating it, you would see the thickness of it, you know, a little bit, and they were just indications of it at first. But you know, I think that started becoming, you know, fans liked it,
yeah.
And it became, you know, there are artists today who don't particularly do that, like, but it became a thing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the more detail for some, the better. And in a weird way, I think that sometimes plays to people who don't know art very well. Like, and yet there are good artists who do detail.
Yeah.
You know, John Byrne was an early artist who did detail. And he was a very talented artist. But sometimes, if you don't kind of know, sort of, if you've never had any formal training in art, you can just assume more detail equals better.
Yeah.
And that's the downside of it, is that I think we do have some artists today who, for all the detail they put in there, you know, would not match overall the classic artist.
Their fundamentals of style and storytelling are not as strong. I agree.
Yeah.
I also think the reason I love this question, Dave, is because you have an opinion on Batman having treads on his boots.
Worst thing ever. Almost ruined the character. Now, I think when Jim Lee was one of the first people I know to like start doing that, maybe around Hush.
Yeah.
When they did the Hush storyline. I had seen realistic costumes, but I had never, you know, Batman, the bottom of his boots were always just looked like sort of like just typical Western boots.
Yeah.
A pronounced heel and not much else.
Yeah.
And there was something, really, I sort of jokingly was annoyed at them.
Yeah, I know.
But those treads, I was like, they look so overthought. And I feel the same way about even a lot of the movie costumes, although I feel Marvel has gotten good at it.
Yeah.
But, like, here's what I remember. When Superman Returns came out.
Yes.
If they showed that like his costume had a certain texture to it. If you super zoomed in on it, you could see that his costume had a slight texture that was made up of millions of little S's, yeah. S shapes, like, yeah. that created a sort of scale effect up close. Yeah. And I was like, that's just ridiculous.
And I get where the costume designers think that'd be cool, but the fact of the matter was, this was supposed to be a costume from Krypton or something, and it's like, that is not what would happen. That's not how, yeah. that would look. But the treads, the weird thing about the treads is it makes sense. If you're going to be in combat, you're going to be jumping around like that, you want good grip on your, sure. on your shoes. You should probably have those awful human foot-looking ones. but there's got to be a blend between what's real and what's cool-looking.
You know, the other thing, by the way, just real quick, is that the older tradition is that artists drew like 2 or 3 books a month.
Yeah.
They could be the best artists in the world, but the idea was to convey story. So they were great storytellers. They had a lot of them times they had very good fundamentals. Some of them were, you know, of course, Kirby and all the EC artists were amazing. Alex Toth and those guys. But they were not, there was no impetus for them to put tons and tons of detail.
Right.
Because they had to do 2 or 3 books a month. Nowadays, no artist in his right mind would really do that. Almost all artists do like a single book. Yeah. And they're sometimes lucky to hit a monthly deadline with that.
Yep.
So they do have more time to put detail in, and like they get better pay rates.
Yeah.
So they do have a little bit more time to lavish that sort of attention.
Yeah.
Whether it's better or worse is going to depend on whether kind of you're an old school guy or a new school guy. I like some of it.
Yeah, that's where I am too.
I think you can take it a little too far, and there are certain artists that do that for me, like Lieber Mayho, things like that. They sort of take the costume to the point where that looks like a motorcycle.
Many folds and seams.
Yeah, or laces, and it's just it detracts from the overall superhero.
It looks like something that they, you know, might have like managed to cobble together in their closet, not like something in a mythic hero wears.
But to go the other way, like with the new Batgirl, the Babs Tarr sort of look, because that's basically what they did. They took like a motorcycle jacket.
Yeah, that was a very specific attempt to.
It was a specific attempt, but it actually is not overly detailed. It looks very adventure-y, very superhero.
Well, it's because they're doing kind of what Dave was talking about the artist used to do. You find a couple of details that matter.
Yeah.
Like the snaps on her cape or whatever. Yeah. You know, but you don't draw every line.
The design of the 90s that Neil Adams did is a perfect example of that. It has kind of a classic Robin look to it and just enough realism to make you think, oh, this is very realistic. Although I've always thought that realism is hugely subjective. Like, if they were really wanting to be realistic, capes are a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Everyone
should have helmets.
Right. Everybody should be wearing body armor. You know, Spider-Man should have body armor. Why doesn't he have body armor? And I'm like, well, he looks so much cooler when he's all sinewy and just leaping around. And he does have a spider sense and everything, too. But
now, here's the question. He asked specifically, is it the printing technology? I don't think that has anything to do with it.
I think it is something of a part. Or it plays some role, just in that you can get more precise reproductions these days.
Okay.
But I think it's a smaller role. I do think that that the increased, you know, the decreased workload of artists, plus fan, popularity trends, a slight trend towards realism.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of stylized artists still, from like Mike Allred,
Scotty Young to Darwin Cook.
Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of those guys who do that still these days, but I think they're probably, I don't know. I don't know if there's fewer of them than there were before, or like overall.
Well, it's
a mixture of things.
He also asked about the movies, and I think that is definitely an influence, especially on Marvel.
So, like, Brian Hitch had designed what could only be described as very movie-style costumes when he did the Ultimates.
Yeah, and those influenced the movies, and then in turn, the movies influenced, like, we all love the Hawkeye classic purple costume.
Oh, yeah.
And we're never going to have that again because it's the movie costume now. It's much more realistic.
I have to say, that's one that I really hate.
Really? I don't hate it. And you'd think I would, because Hawkeye's one of my favorite characters.
Hawkeye, I've gotten used to it. Shades is, he looks like, I can't help but always think he looks like kind of like a dude bro.
Yeah.
Now, and like, what did he look like before? I don't even know how to describe it, really. He looked like sort of a garish Robin Hood.
Yeah.
But the costume design, there were several updates of it over the years.
Yeah.
And like, maybe the very earliest one was a little bit weak, although there were some good basics there.
Yeah.
But like throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and even early 2000s, the variants on the purple one looked really cool to me.
Yeah, you're not wrong. It is one of the great classic costumes, and it has a very different look. He looks a little friendlier, a little more swashbuckling in his old costume.
Right, right.
And this is definitely a realistic, here's a guy with a bow and arrow who will totally shoot you and kill you.
Right. He's got a very seriously designed compound bow and
this is
looks
this
more
is,
like a special ops dude.
This is sort of like the Aquaman thing, I think, in that people didn't – if they had done Jason Momoa clean-shaven in an orange shirt and a yellow pant or an orange shirt and a green pants, people would have freaked out in a bad way.
Yeah, people don't want that. Although I could still see a sort of a slightly more ornamental and armored version of that look.
Yeah.
Where the funny thing is, I see some folks criticize the original Aquaman costume, but I actually think it's
a great costume.
Design. Yeah, the color scheme is very strong. The overall look is good. The little A on the belt is a nice touch.
Yep.
The Silver Age designs, a lot of which I think were by Carmine Infantino for DC, are actually among their strongest and most lasting designs.
Yeah, the Flash is just basically a red costume, but the way it's designed is perfect.
And you know what's funny? Martian Manhunter, one of those guys who, I'm not, in love with the original costume.
No.
But in some ways, it's the only one I've ever thought looked pretty damn good.
Well, it's one of those, it doesn't seem like it should work. He's got
every time they change it, it seems to look worse.
Yeah, he's got the crisscrossing belts over a bare chest, and it seems weird. And he's wearing underwear, and that's it. It's a weird costume. And he's got a cape. It is a bizarre costume, but somehow.
But the colors were good.
It worked.
Yeah.
And every time they tried to improve it, it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's true.
Every new version doesn't work.
I think to some degree, when you look to some of the best versions of the heroes, like Justice League Unlimited, the animated thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Or how they're represented in video games, they do almost always go with those iconic looks.
Yeah.
And I think those are the iconic looks are the most visually grabbing.
Yeah.
I don't know if we answered that question.
Yeah, I think we pretty much covered it. I think we covered it from many angles.
Yeah.
So that's the answer. As always, you can send us more questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. If you want to throw in the subject question for podcast, that'll mark it so we keep an eye out for it. And we will get you a pack of cool comics that we will select.
Yes.
And Steve Maggi will get one this week.
Yes.
All right. We'll be back in just a few moments with our topics for this week. All right, so we're going to talk about a few topics this week. First of all, I had a game night on Sunday, which Dave was too good to attend.
That's true. I was too good to attend, and so I couldn't attend it because I was too good.
Yep. And but Nick came out.
I did.
And we played a few games, one of which Nick had played, I had not, and that was Machikoro.
Yeah, you played a couple of games of
And Machikoro. I played three games of Machikoro. I lost all three. Badly. Former staffer Roxy and her husband won every one.
Yeah.
The McDaniels dominate at Machikoro. But Machikoro, as Nick explained last time, it is basically you're building a Japanese village. Having now played it, it reminds me a bit of sort of cross between Settlers of Catan and Dominion.
Yeah.
Because you've got 10 different types of buildings you can buy. Each building you buy can get you different levels of coins.
So sort of the same way the cards are laid out in Dominion.
Yeah,
so you build your deck from.
You buy them with coins, and then there are different colors. Like the blue ones are whenever anyone rolls that number. And they all have numbers on them.
Oh, I see.
So they have a number from 1 to 12. Some of them have two numbers, like 9 to 10 or whatever.
So that's sort of the settlers part where you're trying to weigh the odds of which ones are going to turn up.
Yes. On your turn, you roll. And on the blue ones, basically, if you roll a 1 – everybody gets a coin because everybody's got whatever the village or whatever the
wheat field.
The wheat field generates one coin when anyone rolls a 1, so everyone gets that. And then there's the mines, which is when everyone rolls a 9, and you roll one die.
Uh-huh.
So you're wondering, how do I get to a 9? Well, one of the things you have to buy to win the game is a train station.
Yeah.
And you pay 4 coins, and then you can roll 1 or 2 dice on your turn.
Oh, interesting.
So early on, those 1s are really good, because anytime anybody rolls a 1, everybody gets a coin.
Mm-hmm.
But when everybody starts rolling 2 dice, the 1s never get rolled anymore, and those wheat fields are useless.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And so it was really neat.
And it does follow the model also of Dominion and the changing strategy of moving from gold to land.
Not yes.
Completely useless. There are things that will give you more money based on some of those
Of notably lower importance.
Lower importance. But there are cards that are red that when someone rolls a die, you have to give them money. Like there's the cafe where if you roll like a 3 to 4, I think, you have to give 2 coins to whoever has a cafe. And there were several people who had like 3 cafes, so you'd roll a 4 and all of a sudden you're giving away 10 coins on that turn.
Bunch of cafe fiends.
And There's all kinds of stuff like that. It was really fun. There's also ones that you roll and you only get it. Like there's one that you get. It's the bakery where if you roll 3 to 4, you get a coin, but only if you roll on your turn.
Now, I have to ask, had the McDaniels played this before?
They had never played it before. No. They just came in and swept up.
A bunch of sharks.
Yep. So we played a couple rounds, and then Nick sat down and we played with the Harbor expansion,
I'd never played.
And I hadn't either. And actually, Allie Porter, who loaned us the copy, had also never played it. And she loaned us, and we got to play her game before she did, which I've run into this kind of thing before because I've done that.
What it really changed up is you can add a fifth player if you want.
Yes, that's a big thing because it's a four player game.
It adds a fifth player, and also sort of the resources in the middle of the table are sort of a rotating grouping.
Yeah, basically there's more than 10. Now there's like 20, and you put 10 out at a time, just like Dominion expansions. Yeah. And then when one pile goes away, when everybody's bought all those, you put a new card out that's available.
But it's a very randomized thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it takes a little bit more planning when you're doing it that way because, you know, you don't have the set number of things out there that you can sort of strategize around. You sort of have to be a little bit more on the ball.
Yeah, the strategy is less obvious. There's more on the fly changing. And also,
I hosed myself because I got a bunch of the green cards, which is basically when you roll the dice, you'll get money.
Yeah.
And everyone else at the table had blue cards. So everybody was getting money but me.
And I hosed myself because I had a mine that gives you 5 gold, and I misread it and that was 1 gold. So I spent several turns getting 3 gold instead of 15.
Oh my!
Well, you know,
so yeah,
that was just a misread of it.
I misread. I forgot that you only got you got 5 gold. I was still second place in that game. Roxy beat me, but I was second place.
As the person who's not played this, it also looks like it's very attractively packaged.
Yeah,
it has cool components. Does it look neat?
The art is really nice. Yeah. It's so easy to learn. You learn it in like 10 minutes.
Yep. And it plays in about...
It plays the base game. I say plays about half an hour. With the expansion, it becomes about an hour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because there's also more stuff to build in the expansion.
That's definitely next on my to-do list.
It is. I loved it. I will definitely be adding it to my game collection. We also played a game, the super fast play game from Looney Labs, the people who do Flux, called Lunacy.
Yeah, basically speed.
It's a picture matching game. So they use all the art from the Flux cards, and each card has 2 pictures on it. So for example, you have one that has chocolate and then the hippie family from the zombies or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's on one. And then there's the weird dog-looking guy and pizza and cookie. And there's all these different pictures.
Yeah.
And then what it is you have a bunch of people, anywhere from 2 to 5, and they have a handful of cards. You start with 7 cards. And you put a card down in the middle, and you're like, everybody ready? And you put a card down, and it will be one of the cards, and you try to match the pictures in real time.
Oh, wow.
There's no turn. You throw down cards. And what we found really made it better was you said what you were putting down. So it was like, so you'd hear this chocolate, dog, weird-looking face guy.
That sounds like an amazing addition.
You try to get to the end. You try to run out of cards first.
Uh-huh.
And if you get to a point where everybody's stalled, where nobody can match the card on the top, you each draw another card, and then you put another card down.
Is that each card has 2 images on
yes.
it?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It is really fun, really fast play. If your reflexes are not so sharp, it may be a really frustrating game.
Yeah.
But it sounds like a fun one if you want to just do something kind of silly and quick.
It was a great one for when we had finished one game, we were waiting for people to finish another so we could start a new one. It was great fun for that.
Another one that you could sort of mix in with the likes of Suro or other games that you play in like 5 or 10.
This is such a super fast game. Yeah. And setup is easy. It's all cards. I really loved it. It was a lot of fun.
Ready? Do you remember from some years ago the now out of print card game Brawl?
Yeah,
where you had different fighters.
I still have Brawl.
It had sort of different color matching like that, and it played out in real time
with
like punches and kicks and stuff like that. But they were essentially color matching.
Yeah,
and it was somewhat like this. And I remember we had a great time with that.
It's the same kind of thing. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Nick referenced the card game Speed, and that's sort of the basis of all of these.
I also played another small card game, Die Monsters.
Yeah, Die Monsters, which is by the guy who did Manticore.
Yeah, which I thought it's got that great look, so it's got great design, great artwork.
It's another weird matching game. It's basically you have five cards representing monsters, 1 through 5. You all have the same – everyone has a deck of 5 monsters,
uh-huh.
The same one. It's identical. And each turn you put down a monster, and then people bid to try and win that monster.
Uh-huh. So it's got elements of sort of liar's dice in some ways because you're trying to figure out what you think your opponent is going to play in order to sort of win. So you're kind of having to do a little guesswork.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But it's very fun, very fast-paced. It's about on the same level of Lunacy. Sort of
it's very quick. Yeah.
I just thought it was a very unique mechanic and very fun. So, I mean, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. All right, so switching over to TV, we're all caught up on Flash. Yes. Spoilers, if you're not caught up on Flash, we're going to talk about the last episode with Firestorm.
Yes.
Spoilers for Firestorm's in the last episode.
Firestorm's been in the last season.
Yeah. So having now seen how they're going to do Firestorm, and I have to say, I'm a little disappointed he's not going to stick around, that he's off doing his own thing for a while.
You know, I'm okay with
but
that.
But makes sense.
He's had a lot of episodes focusing on him lately, so it makes sense to do a slight break.
Yeah, they don't want to do a team-up show. But
who we wouldn't want a Flash and Firestorm team-up show?
Yeah.
We essentially did get full-on Firestorm.
Yeah. They even sort of did the costume, his little glowing thing in his chest.
Yeah, which was a neat idea. Yeah, it was like a little... I forget exactly what it was, but
quantum something.
Yeah, quantum disassembler or whatever they called it, but it was fine.
Quantum splicer.
Quantum splicer,
It's what allowed. It was what controls the process of fusing Professor Stein and Ronnie Raymond.
I love Victor Garber. So seeing him, I'm so used to seeing him as Sidney's dad from Alias.
Yeah.
And sort of being this diabolical, very forthright character. And then
he's
this is
channeling a little bit of that.
A little bit of crotchetiness.
Yeah.
That crankiness that he always, I think, can pull off.
Yeah.
But seeing sort of the effects that Ronnie has on him, sort of because the brain waves are sort of attuned to one another.
They were linked, and so suddenly
the pizza stuff was hilarious.
The surly old guy is like, I need some pizza.
Yep.
But I thought they used that way. They actually used that in sort of practice in the episode of like how to find each other. That was a lot.
They also brought back Wade Eiling, played by Clancy Brown.
I love Clancy Brown.
Man, he is so good as this scummy general.
He eats up roles like this for breakfast and spits it out like the Marines or in Starship Troopers.
Yes, and that weapon he used on Flash was nasty.
Like porcupine?
Yes.
I forgot to talk about
that. I mean, he heals fast, but still hurts.
Yeah, that was nasty. Like, he had like a zillion shards
in
it. For me, the big moment in it was when he was full-on Firestormed up.
Yeah.
And he was, like, blasting stuff. But most importantly, Professor Stein was, like, in his head.
Yeah.
Speaking to him with his disembodied voice.
Yep.
Basically, exactly what happens in the
comics. The only thing that would have made it better is if they had somehow used a special effect to make
little
his ghostly head. Yeah.
I don't know that necessarily would have.
That would have been the best thing ever.
I mean, it would have been awesome.
There's no way.
In the cartoons.
It wouldn't have worked, But
Was it this episode or the previous one that also was the first time the show had sort of addressed, if only in kind of a short
it was the previous one.
Flash and sex.
Yeah. That is the Flash, the fastest man alive at everything.
Yep. Yes. And what was it? Cisco.
Cisco's line is, you're going to have to think of a lot of dead puppies.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic line. My favorite supporting character.
I also, they're moving forward on the Wells stuff. Like, we actually saw him in the costume.
Yeah. I mean, like. I still wonder if there's some twists and turns to be had, but there may not particularly be. It may have just sort of been
viewers,
you know, who didn't know the comics would still be surprised.
Yeah.
Like, they knew he was up to something. They didn't necessarily know he was Reverse Flash.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he looks great in the costume.
He does. And also, it's interesting that Joe's been suspecting him for a while, but now he's got Cisco questioning him. And that's big.
Right.
That's really notable.
That is big. What was the other thing I was going to mention? Oh, and then we also got just a little bit more of Gorilla Grodd.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was the ending. We saw Grodd, and not only did he look great, they did the telepathic voice.
They did the telepathic voice.
That made me so happy.
Yeah.
And now, we were speculating on whether or not we think Ailing's dead, and I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I have a feeling, I mean, they could have, but it would be just as easy for him to, like, take out his revenge by using him as a pawn.
Yeah.
And that would allow him to eventually maybe break free and still make trouble.
The funny thing is, though, he can't break free too early because he now knows that Wells is Reverse Flash.
Right.
So, and he knows Barry is Flash, but that seems to be pretty common. They're going very Bendis on the secret identity here, and that everybody seems to know it.
Yeah.
And I'm a guy who likes your identities, but I think this is a case where it doesn't work. Like, they need to stop lying to Iris casually for no
reason. Flash worked when he had an open identity.
I actually did like that in the comics, when, like, he would just show up at the police station, take off his mask, and just start chatting it up with cops.
Yeah, I like that, too. I like the public identity, and I think that we may be at a point where you don't need secret identities that much.
Well, I think that's
true
for
some.
Yeah.
You know, it worked pretty well when he had his support team, who were really the only ones who know, and his best friend, Joe.
Yeah.
But, like, on Arrow, I think – I haven't been – you know, I'm not as far into Arrow as y'all are, but I think it probably works to – he has to keep a secret identity.
Well,
he's just got too many enemies.
Except that it's getting more open as it goes on.
Is it?
It does seem to be the way of things, that the secret identity seems to not be a thing anymore. It's like Spider-Man's thing.
Right.
It's like he has a secret identity, but like Captain America in the movies, he is sort of a open identity. Yep. People know Steve Rogers' Cap.
Iron Man definitely has
an open identity. Iron Man has an open identity. I think that was one of the first things to break that sort of that he just decided to do the public identity. And I think that it works. I'm a guy, I didn't like when Bendis was so hell-bent on getting rid of secret identities because he doesn't like them.
Right.
And he was hell-bent on getting rid of Peter Parker's. And like every time he wrote a character, for some characters it works. For Flash, I think honestly, I feel like Iris, they're doing that character no favors in making her the only one who doesn't know the secret.
Right. It sort of makes her an outsider.
Yeah, and they need to just go ahead and let her in.
I mean, they're actually clearly doing a storyline where she's kind of pit against them.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense on her because she doesn't know there's nothing sinister going on.
But we can't help but think. She's not with the cool group.
Yeah. I think that to save that character, a lot of people don't like,
it kind of hurts them.
They need to bring her into the loop.
You know, that said, the classic reason for the secret identity does make complete sense. If you were a public figure who fought super powerful bad guys and put them in jail,
yeah,
going after you and your loved ones would be way easy if they know who you are.
Yeah, that's true. Although the jail does remind me that I've seen a lot of people who are very uneasy with this secret prison thing that the Flash team has come up with.
I think they're setting that up.
They're not really raising the moral issues, I think. I think it's just right now they're using it as a comic convention.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think it's a little skeevy, and I kind of wish they'd do the comic convention of someone having a super prison instead.
Well, right. If, like, say this blows up in their face, and they're like, we were foolish to try and take this upon ourselves and take the law into our own hands, but now he's going to, you know, they're going to start level consult with Iron Heights and they'll build their...
Because it was Wells who suggested doing that.
Yeah.
Right.
Wells is a very circum...
And there's also our former staffer, Mandy, who pointed out so they're not even doing some of the practical questions, which is, who's feeding them? Where do they poop?
I'm kind of glad they haven't shown the answer to that, I'll be honest.
Well, like I say, my answer is, well, you don't feed them, and the problem takes care of itself.
I do want to talk about one more element of this episode, because I think it's a big one. It's the time travel element.
Yeah, they've just gone whole hog into that.
Well, I think it was interesting, because they didn't hold that back from Barry that he was the one sort of involved at his mother's
death. I would have been really annoyed if they'd kept that secret.
But that's a general... That's what other shows might have done.
I'm glad they didn't.
I think it's fantastic that they basically got to the meat so quickly.
Yeah.
And I loved the line of him saying, if I know this, I can change it. And instead of just being sort of downtrodden, it's like, oh my God, I failed. And even though they did mention that,
they mentioned it, but they go.
But he immediately was like, I can learn from this and I can do it better next time.
Very classic superhero.
Well,
I mean, some shows, I don't know if Smallville would have done that.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's the big thing about The Flash is that two things you just hit on. One is the optimistic view of the whole thing. It's an upbeat show. They're trying to do good. They're enjoying this. It's not all mopey and how horrible it is and how sad it is to be a superhero.
A few episodes back when they were out training with Flash and there was basically like a drone pursuing him, firing live ammo and stuff. And that is another comic book concept.
Yeah, sure. You're not actually going to shoot so live risky. Machine guns. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, well, Barry's just that good. Yeah. We can do it.
He fires a missile. He can
But more to the point, that scene was fun.
Yeah.
Like they were kind of laughing a little bit. Yeah. And I was like, that's what I wanted. I don't want like, I don't want to feel like Barry's in boot camp. You know?
Barry was even sort of quipping when they're taking spines out of him.
Right.
I mean, this is a fun thing. It's not supposed to be dour and serious.
But my question to you is, how do you think they're going to handle time travel? Or do you think they're going to go full on cosmic treadmill?
I think the cosmic treadmill will be involved because they've already shown it, and they have to do that bit of fan service. But they're not going to go full on Flashpoint. And people say that this is what caused Flashpoint.
Well, right.
But no, I don't think they'll do alternate reality, but I'm not. I wouldn't rule it out.
But do you think he's going to go finds out that created a schism universe?
Yeah.
And then, you know, like in a season or two, he'll find out how things have been progressing in this universe, and it'll be like the mirror universe in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Or, you know, but who knows? They might do it.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you think they're going to go far in the future and they're going to see Wally? Is Wally going to be involved?
I don't think so.
You know,
not Wally, but. Bart.
Impulse or whatever.
Bart Allen.
Broadly speaking, I would prefer them to stake out mostly new territory and not do too many familiar faces and storylines.
Yep. You know, it would be awesome if he saw Jay Garrick, because that was the original.
I don't know that I want them to bring in a Golden Age. Yeah, I don't want it. I don't want the Golden Age.
Because, I mean, like, Jay Garrick could be like a nice old guy who helps him, but he should be
the first Flash.
He's really the first superhuman in their world along with the other people.
I was talking about another alternate world.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
because wasn't that the.
I feel like that's a little too out there. Yeah. The other thing about Flash, though, is that no pun intended, they're moving very fast.
Yeah.
Like, they are not holding back on throwing in time travel, reverse Flash, Gorilla Grodd. There is no none of this pussyfooting around that Smallville did.
Right.
Where it took 10 seasons to get into a costume at the very end.
Right.
Like, they're like, no. Here's superheroes. Here's Firestorm. Here's Ailing. Here's a gorilla.
Supervillains are already accepted in the city.
Yeah.
Because of Cisco's code names are accepted.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's quickly getting there. I also noticed that, like, things like that were a few common cliche plot points that were running a little long, I thought. Like, you know, Barry hasn't told Iris how he feels about her. There was one episode where, like, that seemed like it was going to be a big thing, and then he revealed.
And they cut to the chase, yes.
And I think they're probably going to continue to do that, and it's definitely a good decision.
I think that they're thinking about it. They're looking and seeing what does and doesn't work, and when it doesn't work, they're cutting it out. They're finding a way to get rid of that.
They started doing that in Arrow, at least in, like, second
Arrow's
season.
Doing that too, yeah.
And I haven't seen third season yet, but I assume they continue to do it as well.
But I have one crazy theory to throw out in a minute.
Okay.
Go ahead and finish what you're saying.
No, go ahead. What's your theory?
Just a crazy theory. You know how they recreated the flashback to when the night that Barry's mother was killed?
Yeah.
Cisco took the imprint thing off of the mirror because of the flash energy?
Yeah.
All right, I'm just saying, there is a mirror that is suffused with time, speed force energy.
Yep.
What villain have we not seen yet?
No. Oh, yeah.
I'm just saying, if that were to end up in, like, an evidence locker, you know, to interact with somebody who's maybe already been touched by the particle accelerator stuff,
right.
that could have been a setup.
Yeah.
It also could have just been a just random way to get that plot point out.
But that's
there.
A good point. That I could definitely lead to.
But that mirror was like
that could lead,
super mirror.
That could absolutely lead to Mirror Master, yeah.
Cool.
That's my prediction. I get money if it happens.
All right. Is that how this works?
Yeah.
Oh. All right. One last thing. This is sort of a speculative topic, but there's a bit of fan art that's floating around there, and I'll try to remember to post in our show notes.
Oh, yeah.
Of Spider-Gwen and the new Batgirl.
Yeah. They're, like, taking a selfie together.
Yeah.
And it was just, like, some talented amateur artist, or actually, they might be professional. I don't know. But it was, like, from DeviantArt or something
that.
We can get the credits if we post it.
Yeah.
But it was a really cool piece of art. I mean, like, it looks professional to me. It feels like a cover they could use.
Yeah. And it made us think of the DC Marvel crossovers, which have been off the table for a while because first Joe Quesada and Bill Gemmis sort of had an adversarial relationship with Paul Levitz, and they were sort of on the outs. And now I think Dana Dio, like, there's some adversarial stuff going on with DC that
it's a little
used
over
to.
The Hatfields and McCoys.
Yeah.
You know, they Marvel and DC always used to kind of take shots at each other.
But they've usually been sort of a friendly competition, and the last few years it's been very cutthroat.
Yeah, it definitely has felt more that way. So before we go any further, did you guys enjoy any crossovers growing up?
I didn't read most of them.
Did you not?
No.
Well, I mean,
I definitely had one that stood out for me.
Yeah, which is X-Men Teen Titans.
The X-Men Teen Titans one.
Which I read, but not till years after it came out.
I picked it up at like a 7-Eleven. Had, you know, writing from the big writers of that era, Chris Claremont and Marv Wolfman, Walt Simonson, who I did not yet know yet from his Thor run, drew it and had beautiful artwork. It's where I learned about Darkseid. It's where I learned about Deathstroke.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, because I hadn't read yet the full Dark Phoenix saga, although I knew about it, because there weren't reprints in those days.
Right.
I had to, like, find somebody who had the original issues. It's kind of where I learned about Dark Phoenix, because Darkseid was, like, had resurrected her. a plot point Claremont would go back to the well on many times, but at the time, it had never been done.
Right.
And so I loved it.
Yeah.
I read the 90s DC crossover.
Like Amalgam and stuff?
Amalgam.
I loved Amalgam. I still have all my Amalgam issues.
Dark Claw.
People probably don't know what an Amalgam is. There was a DC Marvel crossover, which fans voted on who would win, which I think led to, like, Wolverine being Lobo. And
Superman and Thor fought.
Storm and Wonder Woman.
Yes, and Aquaman and
Submariner.
I guess they sort of roughly plotted it out and then would write the endings and hastily pencil them based on whatever fans voted.
Yeah, because they
Captain America and Batman?
I think so.
Yeah.
They took a fan vote. Peter David wrote it. As I recall, it was not a great story, but it was an okay story.
Yeah,
given the restrictions on it, surprise,
it
was
a Spanish event.
Yeah. And then at the midpoint, I think, or maybe at the end of it, the two universes merged into something called the Amalgam Universe, where they would merge DC and Marvel characters. And they produced a bunch of one-shots of a lot of good creative teams.
Yeah.
And they carried things like Spider-Boy, which was a cross between the clone Superboy and Spider-Man.
Wasn't that like
Michael Ringo on art? Yeah.
Dark Claw,
which was Wolverine and Batman, which, yep. I mean, you could publish that monthly and people would buy it.
Yeah. I forget some of the other ones.
Thorion of the New Gods.
Oh, that's crazy.
Which was Thor and Orion. I remember Kurt Busiek wrote a Green Lantern Iron Man, Iron Lantern.
Yep. It's a little silly sounding, but...
Isn't Wonder Woman and Storm?
Wonder Woman and Storm. Maybe just called Amazon.
I think it was Amazon.
Yeah. I think John Byrne did that one.
That sounds right.
It had a lot of good creators. It is, of course, so out of print, it's not even funny. I don't even know if they ever collected a trade of it all.
I don't know if they collected some of it. I remember.
I think there were two trades, and I think, like much of the Marvel DC stuff, it's out of print, probably because the two companies can't.
Yeah, they get along, and so they're not going to do it. Yeah. But I love a lot of stuff. I still have my single issues. If I ever decided to delve into making my own hardcover thing, you know, you can get those bound.
Yeah.
That is one of the things I will bind as a hardcover.
There were one or two other notable ones. I mean, you mentioned Busiek, and of course, Busiek did the last big one I know.
JLA Avengers.
I have it.
I love it. I've gotten the big absolute format.
I know.
It's George Perez at his most insaniest.
Yeah.
And I believe he actually injured himself during it, his hand, because he...
Well, because we're doing so many characters.
He was, like, not just drawing everybody who'd ever been in Justice League and Avengers, but, like, a zillion background characters.
Yeah.
Like, most of the whole universes of those characters and all their villains.
And, man, they had... It was a fun story. Basically, when they went to the Marvel Universe, the DC characters were horrified at how real everything was and how, like, they hadn't cleaned up the universe enough.
I always remember Quicksilver going to the DC Universe and visiting Central City.
Yeah.
And he's like, they have a museum for their speedsters here?
Yeah.
And I also remember that off-panel Batman took down Punisher.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It was really good. It used a ton of characters, and I really liked that. There were some good ones in the 90s. There was a Daredevil Batman one that was kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe a Spider-Man Batman.
A Punisher Batman one that Chuck Dixon and Klaus Janson did.
That's right. I liked that one.
And we mentioned John Byrne earlier. He also did a Batman Captain America, which I love.
Oh, that Batman Captain America is great.
It's a period piece, like 40s Batman and 40s Cap, and you know, it's set in World War II, or you know, with World War II sort of supervillain.
And it's just fun.
It is.
Also, the Dark Side Galactus that he did,
you know, with
Silver Surfer,
one,
it was fun.
That went under my radar.
And there's some weirder ones too. I can't think of them off time, but they were cross.
Now that we're talking about it, I'm like, there's a lot of them.
For a while there, they were doing a ton. They were doing them every few months.
And we haven't even mentioned some of the ones that kicked it off in the 70s. That was a little before my time.
Yeah.
Like the Spider-Man, Superman,
right.
Hulk, Batman,
right.
Some weird ones that they sometimes had to find ways to make it all work.
You know, in the 90s had sort of a throwback to that. They did the Superman Hulk that Steve Rude drew.
That's right.
So there were some interesting ones. So
I believe these would sell gangbusters
if they could just reprint the ones they have. We have people looking for those trades.
Oh, yeah.
And
you know, a lot of kids are particularly fascinated
with
what happens when Superman fights Hulk or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was too as a kid.
Yeah.
And some of those are actually, the good news is some of them are even well written
in
addition to being kind of just fun fan service things.
I would like to see. I think it'd be fun to see DC and Marvel crossover.
So Batgirl and Spider-Gwen would be a great
one. There's an obvious one, yeah.
That's they're two sort of best young heroes. Well, I don't know. Miss Marvel would also be great.
Batgirl. Actually, all those together would be great. You know, I'd love to see Punisher and Red Hood.
Yeah,
be interesting.
You know, Randy, did you ever see that fan film?
It's
One of those ones with pretty good production
values. Yeah, I did.
And that was pretty well done.
I'm trying to think of other characters I'd like to see crossing over. Like Harley Quinn and Deadpool is an obvious one.
How about Spider-Man and the Jaime Reyes Blue Beetle? Two kind of
that'd be fun.
Two youth teen geeks.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
With sort of even bug themes to them.
Yeah,
that'd be fun.
Or Doctor Strange, Doctor Fate.
Yeah. Oh, that was one. Strange Fate was one of the amalgams.
Oh,
they mixed
it?
The two of them together.
That's right.
Actually, that. Now that Constantine's the DC universe, you could do Doctor Strange and Constantine.
Yeah,
wow,
that'd be fun.
Those characters not mesh.
New York and London. You do both. That'd be fun.
Those guys are both people who don't really like to take orders. They give orders.
Then you'd have Wong and Chaz.
I like it.
I actually think like maybe the Falcon, Captain America, and Grayson would be kind of fun. Do the spy thing together.
Or Bucky and
or Winter Soldier and Grayson. Yeah,
that would be more fun.
Or to see like what happens. Yeah, like when say yeah, what happens if Grayson goes up against Hydra? There's all kinds of fun mixing and matching you could do with these kind of things.
It's a shame that these companies... I mean, I feel like the people who are on the outs, like Levitz is gone, Quesada's moved on up.
Lobo Deadpool.
Lobo Deadpool, yeah.
I'm just saying.
The people who are sort of against this kind of thing, I think, have mostly moved out. It seems like the enmity maybe may have died down. So maybe this could happen.
I wonder if they're sort of thinking, what's in it for us?
What's in it for you is sales. Can you imagine?
Yeah, but would they be thinking, but we might also be handing off, we might also be creating interest in our competition?
It used to be
they didn't give a crap.
It shouldn't matter, because honestly, do they really think people don't know about both companies?
Right.
Weirdly, we'll see how the cross-promotion between Spider-Man and Avengers, between Sony and Marvel, does.
Yeah, see how the mega corporations play together.
See how they can sort of play together, and then that might have a trickle-down effect of other companies working well with others. So,
yeah.
I mean, but there's no notion of DC working with Marvel again, but
did they ever do Sergeant Rock and Nick Fury in World War II?
I don't know.
Sergeant Rock, I need to see that.
Yeah.
I need to see Easy Company and the Howling Commandos take down some ratsies.
What about Batman and Daredevil?
Yeah, Batman and Daredevil would be great.
Yeah.
Or Batman and Moon Knight. Now that Moon Knight's less of a knockoff.
Actually, who's crazy? I think you need someone sort of crazier over at DC. I feel like you need someone else in that vein.
Richard Dragon.
Iron Fist, Richard Dragon, yeah.
Yeah, you can do it. I'd actually like a thing that had a lot of, a lot of the martial artists of the world in a storyline that had, like, the League of Assassins versus, and some of the Kunlun stuff, yeah, from Iron Fist as, an overarching plot.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Well, that's some of our thoughts. What are some of your DC Marvel matches you'd like to see? You can post them on the Facebook link here or email them to us. We'll read them out next time. That about wraps it up for our 50th podcast episode.
Thanks, and thanks also to our Wednesday customers who participated in our little mini interviews.
Yes, and to Steve Maggi for the question. And until next time, Yo-Jo!